Welcome to Scotch Friday Podcast. My name is Carmel Sacrin, and I'm your host. This podcast is part of our leadership series during the COVID-19 pandemic. I call this podcast Global Pandemic, Local Solutions. I think the title is fitting because this war to stay safe goes beyond our reliance on the federal and provincial governments. Victory requires the engagement of everyone, from international bodies like the World Health Organization, all the way down to local municipalities and health authorities. We need local action to help keep us safe. My special guest today has had her share of controversies and challenges. I think history will judge this as her biggest challenge thus far. And yet she has stepped in front of the health crisis and active on many fronts in the fight to ensure our safety. Please welcome our Burlington Mayor, Mary Ann Mead Ward. Mary Ann, welcome.
Thank you. And thanks to all of your listeners. It's great to be with you.
Happy to have you.
You can hear me. I'll hear you one day.
We can hear you. So you know how this works. I have to give our listeners a little bit about your personal and professional background. So please indulge me. You're married to Peter, who I know shies away from the limelight. You have three children, Miranda, Nick, and Alexandra. In 1989, you obtained your Bachelor of Journalism degree from Carleton University. You have a very long history in communications and media. You're a writer, editor, educator. You've worked for Chatelaine Magazine, Vision TV, Ryerson University, CHCH-TV, and you are a weekly columnist for the Toronto Sun. You were elected as mayor in 2018. You're the second female mayor since Mary Monroe in 1978. You've had your eye on politics since 2006 when you ran against then City Councillor Rick Craven and you lost. Then you ran for provincial office as MP for Burlington in 2007, losing to Joyce Savalee. You returned to journalism. You moved to downtown Burlington, Ward 2, and you ran against incumbent Peter Thome in 2010, and you won a seat on city council. You were reelected in 2014, and then you go big. You run against a two-term incumbent mayor, Rick Goldring, and former MP Mike Wallace, and you win.
Yes.
You don't give up. And well, you are not afraid of challenges.
Not afraid of failure, and you always learn from it. So
wonderful. Now, absolutely. For our listeners, you're in your home office.
I am.
And we're conducting this interview virtually. So if there's some problems in our voice recording, I apologize to our listeners in advance. So let's begin. No one really teaches you how to be mayor. There is no handbook. So how do you approach the office of mayor and your responsibilities? Where do you get your cues on being a good mayor?
Oh, that's a great question. So there are some tips, if you will, some breadcrumbs in the Municipal Act. And the Municipal Act defines the mayor as the head of council, and the CEO, the chief executive officer of the corporation. But beyond that, it doesn't define anything. So you have to figure out what it means to be the head of council and the CEO of the corporation. So you look where you might expect. Residents know that I am currently enrolled in a governance course through the Charter Directors College to talk about what it's like to be the chair of a board. City council functions much that way. And the role of the mayor is very similar to a chair. It is about ensuring voices get heard around the table. It's about making sure the right information comes forward for decision-making. It's about trying to get the group together on a consensus to make a decision. And one recent one that I was really proud of was the tree bylaw that we put in place. And that had been an issue that had been discussed for 9 years, my entire two terms, and even before that, and had been always fractious, 4-3 votes, typically losing. And finally, we worked really hard as a council with our community, with staff, to try and put something together to balance tree protection, but allowing people where necessary to remove trees and collect some money to plant more.
Go ahead.
Well, and that was a unanimous vote.
Well, so, it's not foreign to you to sit around a boardroom table. You were a board member of the Board of Governors at Joe Brandt, and
Absolutely.
You're very familiar with the process of consensus, discussion, consultation.
So absolutely. And, you know, the role of a mayor in municipal councils, it's very different than federal and provincial. You don't have a whip, a party whip, to tell your fellow party members how to vote. I would never want that. I like the consensus approach. But you can't tell people how to vote, and you can't compel people how to vote. You can't kick them out of your party if you don't like what they're doing. You, for better and or worse, you're stuck with the council that the public gives you, which is great, because it actually forces everybody. You're one voice around that table, but you're a powerful one. But it requires us to come to consensus. And for me, as a decision-making model, I think that's the best one. And the most similar comparison, of course, is to a board.
So what do you think is your primary role during this period in our history?
Keep people safe. That is job number one. And they, because, you know, the province sets sort of the broad brush strokes. You know, you have to close facilities till a certain date, but the municipality has to figure out, okay, but how do we still deliver the services the public expects us to? We still have people applying and receiving building permits. We still have our tree folks going out and making sure there's no public hazards. We have actually received very favorable pricing on some of our tenders for road work and road repair. We have to keep our city's infrastructure in good shape. We have to keep our people healthy and safe at the regional level. We're all regional councillors. You know, the water still has to come on, garbage still has to be picked up. So there are essential services that our community needs, and we have to deliver those in a safe way for both our employees and staff. That means a whole new way of doing stuff. And that's doing it offline, doing it from the home office, using digital tools. So, you know, I'm happy to say the city has adapted, but through it all, we have to find not only new ways of delivering those services, but job number one is keeping our community safe and interpreting how to do that, setting those policies. And, you know, to date, Burlington, among all of our Halton municipalities, has the lowest infection rates. And I think that's because of some of the leadership, and it's not just me, you do this as part of a team of council and staff. But the public has been willing to do their share too. And that's really tough. To stay home and be isolated is really tough.
We're going to discuss some specifics, but just before we go down that road, I want to ask you, and I've asked one other person that I interviewed, what do you think people perceive as good leadership?
Compassionate, agile, willing to change when you get new information, empathy, and a good listener, right? I think the best leadership consults broadly, but not being afraid to make a decision and stand by it as well. And learn from your failures. I'm a silver lining person. I think that's a hallmark of good leadership. So in every situation, including this one, I look for the silver lining. I think there will be good changes to our world after this in terms of how to keep people safe, infection control that will help. Even if we solve COVID, we've still got lots of other infectious diseases, right? There's C. diff, there's SARS, there's the flu. We'll be better equipped to keep our community healthy and safe coming out of this. We've figured out new digital ways to do something. I think the workplace is going to be revolutionized in ways that are helpful, where people don't have that, you know, 2-hour commute every day to the office. We've figured out how to give people more time in their day through electronic Zoom meetings that we're all, you know, very quickly learning. So I believe, you know, good leaders look for those opportunities while going through those difficult times. So make your decisions quickly, adjust as you need to, and always be kind and compassionate, because it's never easy.
So I'm going to share a personal story with you. Last week I mentioned to my 14-year-old daughter that I was going to interview you on the show, and to my complete surprise, she immediately responded assertively. She said, "She's awesome." And I said to her, and I turned to her, I was rather surprised. I said, "Well, how do you know her?" And she said, "Well, I follow her on Instagram." So So my daughter follows you on Instagram, and it appears that you've made quite an impression with her, my daughter Grace, and she will not like the fact that I mentioned this story to you. But I imagine you've made an impression on many other young women. How do you feel about that?
That is a huge honor and a huge privilege. You know, I say to them, and I had an International Women's Day meeting where I had young women from each of the schools come and meet me for lunch. And you know, you mentioned my political history there, where I lost two elections before I won three, and I said to them that I don't see those losses even as failures. They were learning experiences. It obviously wasn't my time yet. And that's fine. I use the time wisely for something else, but I knew it was right for me too. So sometimes failure is an indication that something's not right. Sometimes failure is an indication that it is right, but it try again. And you know, any successful leader in any field, whether it's sports or politics or business or anything, will tell you that they failed more times than they succeeded on the path to succeeding. And so perseverance is key. And, you know, learning how to develop a thick skin, right? It's a hard balance to be empathetic and to allow yourself to feel the pain that your community feels, while also making those tough decisions that need to be made, and be resilient when you get that criticism, because it'll come. It does come always, and you won't, you know, make people happy. But, you know, if I can inspire one woman out there to go into elected office, I will be very pleased, because right now in Canada, less than 30% of elected officials at all levels are women, and less than 25% of mayors across this country are women. And women have a different way of doing things. We represent half the population. We need to be reflected in the decision-making process, and we're not. And so I always hope that when young women see that there's a woman mayor who, as you said, took on a two-term incumbent and a former member of parliament and won in a campaign that was the dirtiest election campaign this city has ever seen, amplified by social media, it's possible. That success is possible. And I hope that my story gives them the hope they need to try big things, not be afraid of failure, go for their dreams, persevere. And I'd love to sit and have Grace in my office one day when we can do these things again.
Well, look, there've been some observations commented to me in anticipation of this discussion, that Burlington has taken the lead among many municipalities to lead with this, to deal with the pandemic. And we'll discuss these points further in detail, but I want to quickly reference that we're one of the first cities in Ontario to call a state of emergency.
Absolutely.
You have the COVID-19 Task Force Committee. You've had two telephone town hall meetings. There's regular information and communications that you're putting out on social media and mainstream media. And in fact, you're challenging us, even though the province recently commented otherwise, that to keep within a five-car procession for celebrations. So you seem to be a step ahead of this situation, and even challenging the province on how many cars should be in procession. But you are busy. You are simply busy. I'm not going to ask you about your typical day, but is the business of city council still being conducted?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have a full slate of committee meetings next week. We were one of the first councils that got right back to business. So we haven't skipped a beat. Our last council committee meeting was March 12th. On March 13th, the province was shut down and the city was shut down. We had our next set of council committee and council meetings in April as scheduled. And next week we head into a full round of committee meetings and big agendas, right? Our last council meeting set a record at 8 hours because we were dealing with new reports on the finances, which I know we'll talk about, on on service delivery changes, on all of the things that have been happening, as well as the regular business of the city, which still continues. We're an essential service, so we have to. We have to continue to serve our community on the things that they need for their daily lives. So, and you know, if you look at say Toronto, they hadn't had a council meeting at all until a couple days ago. The decisions were all run through the mayor, and I don't mean that as a criticism. I think Toronto's doing an awesome job. I think Mayor Tory is doing an awesome job. It's just different. And so your question around, is the business of the city still going forward? Absolutely. And council is still meeting, committee is still meeting. And now, in addition to the regular business of the city items, we are dealing with COVID emergency items. And we lifted the 5-car restriction, by the way, because the province provided some clarity, which was great. And, you know, part of our task of decision making, it's not going to get any easier with the pressures to reopen. The province sort of sets the broad parameters. We have to interpret. We're going to have to keep interpreting, and we're not going to be afraid to do that.
Right. Tell me about the telephone hall, town hall meetings. What inspired this idea?
Well, a lot of it came from some of the council members where they said, you know, there are people that I know in my ward, and it's different by wards. There's greater proportion in some wards and areas of the city than others where people don't have access to computers or don't use them very much. They're not on social media, some by choice, just, you know, to get their information a different way. And so we thought, how are we going to invite those people to participate in the conversation? Because we don't want anybody left out. And so the telephone town hall, you know, pretty much everybody has a phone. And so we had over 4,000 people on both calls at one point in the call. The first call was an hour, and we went a little over that. We went an hour and 15, and the second we booked for 2 hours, and we took the full 2 hours. And you know, that we could never have had a regular town hall with that many people. We don't have a venue big enough. And so what we were talking about earlier about silver linings, these are some of the things that we've learned through this that we need to keep doing. It's just a good idea. It allows people directly in huge numbers to hear directly from their mayor and the senior leadership at the city, to hear questions, answers to their questions, to ask questions in real time in a size and scale that just isn't possible outside of that venue. So we're going to keep doing that. We're already talking about another town hall and doing it regularly, whether that's every 2 weeks or once a month. We're not out of this pandemic for months and months. We know this. There's going to be implications that are with us for a very long time. So we need to keep using those creative ways to connect.
I can imagine your office is extremely busy with constituent phone calls and inquiries. What seems to be the primary concern of the constituents in the messages and the communications that you're receiving?
They're really twofold. One is folks who are concerned where they see social distancing rules not being followed, and they're very concerned about their health and others. So we get a lot of those calls. What can I do? Or if they are in a workplace as an employee or as a customer and they see practices that aren't being followed, they want to know where to report that and get some action, because that's their safety. That's everybody's safety. So we field a lot of those. And a lot of that we redirect to the Halton Police. There's a COVID hotline phone number, 905-825-4722. So if people are concerned about anything, call that line, and then that will get filtered to, first of all, the right municipality, but the right department. Ministry of Labor is receiving phone calls around unsafe practices. So if you're an employee that it feels concerned about what's happening, or you are a customer, you can do that. The other side is people, and this is something I appreciate so much about Burlington residents, they are really trying to do the right thing. And that's why I think our numbers are lower than other areas. It's why I think we are relatively healthy. We've still had, obviously, infections, but people are asking things like, can I put my kayak in the water, and can, you know, That was one recent one. And, you know, I had somebody ask me if they could go for walks with their friend as long as they stayed 6 feet apart. And, you know, they're really trying to still have some normal life, getting out and enjoying exercise, doing something, because people in many cases are at home and not working. So those are the two primary ones we get, is expressing concerns and how to enforce the rules and what people can do. And we're just going to keep getting more and more of those, both types.
So we know that you've implemented you formed a COVID-19 task force. Can you tell me a little bit about this group and what inspired the idea? Who are they and what's the purpose?
Sure. We almost right away, before we had even declared a state of emergency, myself and Eric Vanderwall, the president and CEO of Joseph Brant Hospital, who, as you mentioned earlier, I know well from my days sitting on the board of Joseph Brant Hospital. We started setting up daily phone calls, because COVID is not only an emergency, it's a health emergency. And we knew that the first place that would get slammed if we had a spike would be the hospital. And so how would the city and the hospital be able to work together? Through those conversations, we felt that, you know, there were other agencies each dealing with the emergency in their own way. But if we're going to take care of the health of the community, not just physical health, but mental well-being, we need to get all these voices around the table to share expertise. So, you know, the city has an emergency group, and the hospital has a pandemic response group, and the school board has a group, and Team Burlington business groups have come together. And so we thought, everyone's got an emergency response that they're working on. We all need to talk to each other, because there are areas where our work will intersect, and we want to make sure we can support and just be aware of that. So I asked 50 community leaders and elected officials who represent Burlington to join the task force. They all said yes. And more hands went up in the air in the days after it was announced, people wanting to be part of this and be part of a community response. And again, that's something I think I will keep going after the emergency's over. Municipalities, well, none of us work in a vacuum. And at some point, our activities do nudge up with other work, and we want to be aligned. So
how often do you meet?
It's been great. The task force right now is weekly. Yeah, it's every week. And there are two council members that have joined me on that. Councillor Lisa Kearns, who is the council appointee on the Joseph Brant Hospital Board, and Councillor Angelo Bentivania, who has been a fundraiser for the hospital, is a local business person, and of course, also a counselor. So he wears many hats. And then every community group that you can think of is represented around that table, as well as police. You know, we've got military around the table, we've got first responders, we've got the region represented. So it's, you know, and already one of the first things that the task force put together was a group, like a page of resources. So if you need help, one-stop shop. If you have help to give, one-stop shop, and a whole bunch of resources. If you're an agency involved, here's where the grant money is. If you're a business, here's where the federal and provincial dollars are. So that came out of the task force, is we need to get the resources directly to people instead of them having to go in different places to find it.
So I imagine you're getting direct reports regularly from local health officials. Can you tell me about that? How's that happening?
Yeah, so Halton Region is obviously is where public health sits for us in a two-tier municipality, and they do daily updates. They have a page directly from their homepage, so halton.ca. You can see the age of people infected. You can see how many, what the numbers are by municipality, and you can see where the outbreaks are, whether it's long-term care home outbreaks or hospital, or, you know, if a workplace even had one, that would be reported. So, and then there's a lot of really helpful information and links to other areas as well. So that's, again, one-stop shop, one page on Halton, and that is updated daily.
Can you, how did you come to learn about the temporary 93-bed pandemic unit at Joe Brant? I'm assuming Eric called you and said, we're going to be doing this. Can you tell me about that conversation?
Absolutely. So as part of our conversations, he said, you know, we need to be ready in case there's a surge of cases, because not only is COVID deadly to some people who get it, and yes, there are vulnerable populations, but there are also people who just get it and can't, their body can't fight it. And so it's deadly. So there's that, but the other issue is even if we can treat people, if they all present at the hospital at the same time, because this thing spreads like wildfire, then you've got a surge. And it's not so much that we don't have the ability to care for people, it's that we don't have the resources. We've been overwhelmed, and the hospital has been overwhelmed. And we've seen that in other countries where they have the know-how to treat this, you know, ventilators and other things, but they don't have enough, because all of a sudden they went from nobody needing one to thousands of people needing one overnight. And so to handle that potential surge, and the modeling that that the province had, which they eventually, and kudos to them, released to the public, the hospital also had that modeling predicting we're gonna see a surge in mid-April. Well, we need to be ready.
You and I know Eric, and I think we'd agree that he's future thinking. He's a future.
Absolutely.
Thinker. He's always looking ahead. And I, to my knowledge, I think Joe Brant is the first hospital in Ontario, or maybe the only hospital that has created such a temporary pandemic unit. I don't know of any other hospital that has done.
There isn't. Yeah, there isn't one. And so, you know, the dealing with a pandemic like this is you're right. He'd be a great one for a podcast, by the way. I'm sure you've asked him, but, is you look at the modeling and you say, okay, if nothing changes, if behavior doesn't change based on this disease, we're going to see this kind of spike in cases and we only have this many beds. Therefore, we need to prepare. Then you start at layering in all of the restrictive measures and the fact that people did immediately, especially in Burlington, start to social distance as soon as, you know, for the most part. And so all of a sudden the trajectory, we did bend it. And so instead of the worst case scenario.
Can you share those numbers with us, Marianne? Just quickly, can you share those?
I could, but I don't have them off the top of my head.
Okay, no worries.
Yeah, it was just showing essentially that would be over 100% capacity. And as soon as you're there, then you're in trouble, because you can't properly treat people if you don't have enough capacity. So the projection was by mid-April, we're going to hit this peak. In order to deal with that, we need to get a pandemic in place, obviously, before that. So you have to back up your decision-making in anticipation. Then the measures started working, and people were listening. And so the curve got flattened. But so the unit is still there. It has not been needed to be used because of a whole pile of other measures that they also took to release capacity in the hospital, you know, not doing certain surgeries and so forth. They can now start talking about that. But the other thing that then came in on the side and kind of hit us all was the communal living, congregate living situation. So that's long-term care, that's group homes, that's domiciliary hostels, you know, those kinds of homeless shelters where people are in close contact. And so now we have this pandemic response unit, if needed, to deal with some of those issues in those homes as well.
So I'm just conscious of time, and I want to try and cover this very quickly. Communications with other levels of government, like the province and the federal government, what kind of communications are you currently having with those levels of government?
So we are working very closely through our elected officials. So my office is in almost daily conversation with our local MPP, Jane McKenna, and she also briefs the other two MPs that have a part of Burlington. So Pam's at the federal level, but Effie Triantafilopoulos at the provincial, Parm Gill. We're in regular touch. We make sure that Karina Gould, her office, as well as Adam Van Coverden. So we've got six elected representatives that have some part of Burlington. We keep them all apprised. I'm also part of the Large Urban Mayors Caucus, and we had a meeting last week. We have one coming up this week, and ministers, provincial ministers, join us. So we have direct access and collaboration there, and through our Association of Municipalities of Ontario and Federation of Canadian Municipalities. So Councillor Nissan is our representative for Halton on FCM. So we have lots of channels for direct contact. We're using every one of them.
Would you agree that this level of communication, the mayor's ability to get your message right up to the premier's office and the prime minister's office, is unprecedented? Would you agree with that?
I don't have an experience before now, so right. I'm a mayor in a pandemic in my first year in office, so it's looking all good to me. I don't know what it was like before, but. You know, what I have seen, and I think what we've all seen, is the setting aside of partisanship. And so people setting aside party politics and saying, look, we're going to work together. It doesn't do the community any good to see different levels of government fighting in a pandemic. And so the collaboration that we've seen across party lines at those levels has been outstanding. And municipalities being a part of that conversation. And that's one of the things I hope is a learning that comes out and lasts longer than COVID, that we learn a better way of doing democracy where we're not divided by partisanship, we're united on serving our community, and certainly a stronger role and voice for municipalities. I think everyone has seen we're on the front lines and with limited tools. So
we're hearing, we're now starting to hear a conversation about reopening up our region. I know that there's a Halton Mayor's Recovery Coordination Group.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that group and how this reopening might happen?
So the four Halton Mayors have come together to really coordinate our efforts to reopen and redesign our communities, because we know that we're not going back to business as usual after this, and we really shouldn't, because there's lots of good changes that I think can happen as a result of our learnings. So we want to make sure that we are sharing information with each other, and to the degree possible, making decisions that are the same. So, you know, a great example would be, you know, when the time comes to lift the declaration of emergency, we want to make sure we all do it at the same time and with the region. I think that's best for our community, so that all there's a one Halton response message. It's not confusing or this patchwork of there's still emergency over there, but not there. We need the province obviously to go first. We can't lift anything if their provincial emergency orders are still in place. But as soon as they do, our mayors will be ready to work together with the region, so the five of us, the four mayors and the regional chair, to align that. And that's just one example. We are going to be making decisions for months about, you know, the province sort of sets the parameters of who can open, like parks coming up. We know that's coming, but they kind of leave the fine grained details to us. So again, we want to make sure that we're, you know, because our people go between municipalities, we want to make sure that there's consistent messaging. And I think that's better for the public because it's not confusing. They get one message, they get one, you know, consistent set of suggestions around how to keep themselves safe. So that's what we're all about. And we meet every week and it's great.
So let's move away a little bit from COVID. I know there's another issue that is important to council and the city. I saw a recent announcement from provincial officials that there is no longer a provincial requirement for a mobility hub to be included in municipal official plans. And I know this is important to you. City Council have pushed for its removal. Why is this important? What is it and why is this important?
So the mobility hub and major transit station area designations were put by the province on downtown Burlington. And the MTSA specifically was used to justify overdevelopment downtown. We lost a significant Ontario Municipal Board case that allowed a 26-story building downtown because it was near our little bus terminal, which is a designated MTSA. And we put the interim control bylaw in place for a year to study the role and function, because in provincial policy, there was no distinction between our little bus terminal that has 300 people a day going through it and Pearson Airport, which is also an MTSA that has a million people a day. So, you know, clearly the kind of development that is warranted around those MTSAs that have different volumes would be very different, but there was no distinction in provincial policy. So we also recognize that we want to direct growth to our GO stations, because the really, when you look at provincial policy and the study results of the study that we did, are that they should really be on higher order, frequent transit, inter-regional transit. That's your GO station. And we think the MTSAs should be there. We have one already at the Burlington GO. So it's about directing growth where it should be and where it belongs in terms of the most dense growth. So we said it really doesn't make sense to have an MTSA downtown with a little bus terminal. It makes a whole lot of sense at the GO stations, and we need your help because you designated it that way in the first place. We need you to fix it. And then we got the letter saying, yep, green light, go ahead. So we have some T's to cross and I's to dot to make that happen, but that is great news for the community.
Well, Marianne, we're sadly out of time, but do you have any final messages to the people of Burlington?
I just want to say how proud I am of our community. They have stepped up to help each other, to keep each other safe, to make sure that everybody who is in need, whether that's food or a visit, is looked after. And, you know, I've been so proud. The ingenious, creative ways people have found to come together, even in the midst of a global pandemic. And I can say, and I've said this many times, it makes my job as mayor easier because I have such a great community to serve. So thank you.
Thank you, Your Worship. Thank you for your leadership. Thank you to all city councillors, to city staff, and to all those working to keep our city operating and looking out for our best interests. Thank you even to the sanitation and garbage collectors and recycling workers. Thank you to everyone who helps run this city. I'm sure our listeners are very thankful that they still have garbage pickup and recycling pickup. And
yeah.
Cecilia's, I know there's regional responsibilities there, but thank you to everyone that keeps our municipality operating. We are indebted to each and every one of you and to our mayor. We are so very proud of your strong leadership during these scary times. So thank you to you and everyone else. Please remember to our listeners, please remember to have your say and go to our comment section on our website, scotchfridays.ca. My name is Carmel Sacrin, and I thank you for listening to this podcast. Until next Friday, goodbye and be safe.